Now, depending on who you listen to, the worst of the global financial crisis is either over, or as I was saying before, the other boot is about to fall, and the massive stimulus spending will plunge the nation and the globe into debt for decades to come. Now, as we know, the Reserve Bank is in the optimistic camp. It raised interest rates last week, is likely to keep doing so in the expectation, the hope, the prayer that the economy is returning, while Ken Henry, the sainted Treasury boss and the increasingly politicised head of Treasury, is less certain. But he reckons economic recovery is still at risk, and winding the stimulus spending back now would cost over 100,000 jobs. Now, as I said, you're not going to like hearing what my next guest has to say, because he is emphatically, emphatically on the pessimistic side. His mantra is debts that can't be paid won't be paid, and whether the debt is a property mortgage or a credit card bill, and propping up creditors who made bad loans is bad for business. I can't begin to list all of Michael Hudson's credentials, but he's a former Wall Street financial analyst. He's now president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. Now, there's a fascinating and relevant institute. That's in the US. He's Distinguished Research Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. He's here amongst us for a series of public lectures at which he will not be saying we're on the road to recovery. Michael, welcome to our little wireless program, and I'm glad to see that despite your pessimism, you've still got a smile.
Well, thank you very much. The question is, what is it that is supposed to be recovered? Whatever happens, if there's an upswing, if things look better, the world of the future is not going to look like the world of the past, and that's a good thing. That's not pessimistic. The world of the past is what got us into this mess. The polarization, the idea that somehow making real estate more expensive was a way to get rich instead of just pushing people further and further into debt.
Michael, the thing that worries me is if there is light at the end of the tunnel, that the locomotive rushing towards that light is pretty much the same engine pulling the same carriages that we had before. I'm delighted to think there may be some changes, not simply a second act.
Well, the reason I say that, I've just come from Latvia, and Latvia is the most troubled economy and debt collapse in the world because
worse than Iceland?
Almost worse, in the sense that although the European Union is against both Iceland and Latvia, Latvia is one of the post-Soviet economies that emerged in 1991 with no debt at all. All of the public infrastructure are free, no property claims. But they had a structural trade deficit because all of the Soviet Union's production facilities were torn up.
So its manufacturing base in Latvia just disappeared.
Totally. The first thing the Europeans did was say, we want to export to you our textiles. Junk your textile factories, destroy your factories, don't set up banks of your own. You will have a trade deficit, but we will lend you foreign currency loans against your real estate, and you will finance your trade deficit by running into debt. But the way you'll run into debt is to have a real estate boom, and we'll lend you enough
money. And we know
money.
Where those lead.
Now, that's right.
Michael, you've been working at some official level in Latvia, I understand.
Yes, I was research director of the Riga Graduate School of Law. I'm a consultant to the ruling party of Riga, now Harmony Center. I've taught there for a number of years and have met with a number of prime ministers.
Okay, but Latvia is a bit far from, if you like, the consciousness of your audience tonight. So we might return to it, but let's look at some other things here. I know you're very critical of the way the Obama administration, picking up, I think, on some initiatives of his predecessor, has chosen to tackle the crisis. Why? What's your complaint?
He's continued the Bush policy completely. You had a problem in America that the debts were way in excess of people's ability to pay. Right now, one quarter of American real estate is in negative equity. That means that the mortgage is higher than the amount that has to be paid. So what Obama did was to continue the Bush administration, and together they gave $13 trillion of bailouts to the creditors, not a penny to the debtors. So they paid the creditors for all the bad loans by creating $13 trillion of treasury bonds and taking the Fannie Mae and the mortgage lenders onto the public balance sheet. They call that socializing them, but it's more an oligarchy than socialism. And they didn't give any write-off at all to the debtors. So,
it does sound dreadful. Might I ask you where you stand or sit on the political spectrum in the U.S.?
The strange thing is that finance doesn't have anywhere on the political spectrum. The financial discussions span left and right. On the left spectrum, in America and in Europe, the left is not talking about economic issues at all. They're only talking about political issues, and that's why the left lost so badly.
Well, one of those is jobs, isn't it, as we do here?
Yes, but they talk about jobs, but they don't have any discussion of economic policy and what's responsible for the loss of competitiveness, why the jobs aren't there. They don't point to the amazing concentration of wealth that's occurred in the last 25 years in America. The upper 1% in America 25 years ago had 37% of the wealth. In 2004, they had 57%. And last year, the 1% of America owns two-thirds of all of the returns to wealth. And
so that's you sound like a lefty when you say that. But
that's just, I'm a statistician.
Yeah.
And I do the statistics. The left doesn't follow any of this, so they don't pick up what I'm doing.
It's basically, the right?
The right picks it up because they want to know what's happening. And most of the people who hire me are Wall Street firms. I've underwritten the First Third World Bond Fund for Scudder Stevens. It's amazing that only the right is talking about the issues that really matter, the economic issues.
I think you'd find a good audience in Malcolm Turnbull here, who is, as you know, saw more or less the leader of the Her Majesty's opposition. What about Australia? We beat our pectorals and say that our government didn't have to bail out the banks like they did in the US because, they were better regulated or perhaps more sensible. And the mainstream view of local economists is that we've handled the crisis better than most. Yes or no, Michael?
I think you're going down exactly the same route that the United States, Iceland, and Latvia did. And the reason I mentioned Latvia isn't that here's a small country that I know about. It's that that's the most seriously affected country and has begun to change rules in probably the way that I expect Australia will change them. Australia may face the Latvian-type scenario or the Icelandic-type scenario.
I'm happy to talk about Latvia. Oodles on Iceland. We've done a bit on Ireland. We've wandered around the world. Okay. We've looked at China. We've looked at India. By all means, let's look at Latvia. But what are the parallels, the potential parallels between...
In Australia now, the government is promoting 100% loans with guarantees to the banks. Now, when the government says, we're going to give you a guarantee for 100% mortgages to people, that means that the banks are going to tell their loan officers, you're going to get a bonus for however many loans you make. We want to make as many loans as we can because that's how we make interest. Don't worry, the public's going to pick up the tab later on, just like they have in every other country of the world. So the loan officers are not going to care very much about the quality of loan.
So once again, the train coming out towards the light, the alleged light at the end of the tunnel, is the same train.
The same train. Cycles, financial cycles, occur in the same way everywhere for centuries. And when somebody says, there's no, look, I'm defying gravity, they're just about to take the plunge.
You have a long, distinguished career in the belly of the beast. You worked in and around Wall Street. Has Wall Street learned anything other than the government will provide a safety net?
Yes, it's learned that you have to give very heavy contributions to the political campaigns of government people who will assure to bail you out.
Simple as that.
Yes.
Simple as that. Okay, what about the Reserve Bank raising interest rates here, the expectation that they'll keep cranking them up from what they consider to be artificially low rates? I understand you think this is very bad policy.
Well, the first thing it will do is increase the amount of debt service paid by the two-thirds of homeowners that have adjustable-rate mortgages here. And that means that they're going to have less spending on goods and services. So when the interest rate goes up, that diverts income away from being spent on goods and services, to be paid to the bank, and the bank is going to take this money and lend it out to raise home prices even more, and people will have to work even more years of their
life. But, Michael, we also gave a check to every consumer for $900. Some seem to spend it in the shop, some spend it on their mortgages. Was that better policy?
Probably better than inflating real estate prices and making people have to go further and further into debt to afford a home. I'd rather give them money than take money out of their wallets.
Now, one of the things that Glenn Stevens, who, as you know, is the big cheese of the Reserve Bank, said in justification of the rates rise, was that economic conditions in Australia have been stronger than expected. Measures of confidence have recovered. Now, that, of course, concerns the psychology of the market. And, God, we hear a lot about the psychology of the market. Are you a psychologist of the market,
too? Absolutely not. I'm a quantifier. I do statistics and I do a quantitative analysis, and the psychology is sort of an after-the-fact, a label that they put on it. It has nothing to do with psychology. It has to do with how much money is coming into the market to set prices, how much is going out. If somebody talks about psychology, you may put them in the public relations department, but you don't put them in the analysis department.
One of the things that fascinates me about your line of argument is a warning that I haven't heard before, that Australia needs to keep its interest rates as low as they are in the US and elsewhere to stop financial raiders coming in. What's that all about?
There are many ways. The way to stop a financial raider coming in is to have a good tax system and a well-structured economy, so there's nothing to raid.
But why does raising the interest rates encourage financial raiders?
Because people can borrow from America now, as they used to borrow in Japanese yen at 1%, and they can lend it to Australia at 6%. Credit is created freely. It's created on a keyboard, just like the keyboard in front of you, except it's connected to a bank computer.
So is this. All of this feeds into the Reserve Bank.
That's right.
They wait my every move here.
So it's credit creating is free, and the banks have a privilege of creating this, a monopoly of creating this, and they can lend, create it at 1% in America, and somebody will borrow it and invest in Australian bonds at 5% and make a 4% commission for doing nothing, absolutely free. Now, why would
Australia...
Sounds
fun, really.
Yes.
But as you know, we're new best friends with China. Won't China save us? They want to dig up Australia in its entirety and ship it over there.
They certainly are the market for your raw materials, and that's what makes Australia different, that it doesn't have to make its labor more competitive. It can squeeze its labor, it can price it out of the market, it can say, we have no industrial jobs for you, there's no work for you, you can be unemployed, but don't worry, we're doing fine because we're selling our subsoil resources to China. We don't need labor.
Subsoil resources, I like that. Let me reintroduce you again. This is LML on Radio National, abc.net.au/RN. And the economic blasphemy you're hearing is coming from Michael Hudson, who's a former Wall Street financial analyst, now, and I take a deep breath, president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and distinguished research fellow, professor of economics at the University of Missouri. When you, this presidency you have, the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, who funds that?
Harvard University has funded most of our studies. It was started as an Assyriological and Archaeological Institute.
A what?
Archaeological.
No, that I understand.
Assyriological is
Assyriological.
A study of Babylonian and Sumerian origins. And all of the enterprise practices that modern civilization has were developed in the ancient Near East in the 3rd millennium BC. Interest, the charging of interest, negotiated agreements, real estate markets, all of that was developed long ago. The surprising thing is they were developed in the public sector, not by private individuals. They were developed in the temples and palaces of Sumer and Babylonia. And we have all of the legal contracts, the business contracts, and this is...
Michael, I have a passion for archaeology, and it's delightful to at last meet an economist who talks archaeology. This is a new experience.
Well,
tell me about how this false bounce that you think we're having, this illusion of a comeback.
I don't see any bounce at all. The unemployment has continued to go down. People say, how can you say that there's...
Unemployment's continued to go up.
Unemployment to rise to above 10% in the United States now. How can there be a recovery without a rise in employment? What is it that's recovering, as I said in the first sentence? And what's recovering is the government pumping masses of money into the wealthiest 10% of the population to bid up the stock market. If you give $13 trillion to the financial sector, of course, the financial stocks are worth $13 trillion more, and that will go up.
What would you have done, or what would you have advised your shiny, bright new president were you invited to do so? What would he have done differently if you had his ear?
He would do nothing differently, because I don't give him the campaign contributions, and he would listen to me, but he would do nothing differently because he's already bought.
That's an incredibly tough and cynical line. I thought the thing that made Obama different was that he had a mosaic of tiny contributors, you know, the kids that were voting for him with financial donations, quite small.
No, his largest contributors are the largest real estate developers in Chicago, the Crown family and the Pritzker family.
So he's no different from his predecessor in that sense.
Well, let me tell you what makes him different. I gave a lecture up at Harvard at the law school a year ago, and afterwards a professor came up to me and said, you know, as editor of the Law Review, at Harvard, usually that's the most prestigious position of any student in America. He said, normally everyone for the last 50 years has gone and become a clerk of the Supreme Court, but Obama became a community organizer. And I looked at him, and he said, do you know what a community organizer is? And I said, no. And this is a black man, about 95 years old, one of his teachers. And he said, a community organizer is somebody who works with the real estate reverends and the real estate interests and the big banks and gentrifies a city, who tears down the black slums, forces them out, gentrifies them, and then makes a killing on where they're moving to.
And when you say that, you sound a bit like a woman who ran for the vice president with McCain. You know, she made the same sort of disparaging remarks about community organizers.
I think she was referring to the politics, and I'm referring to the fact that it's all about real estate. That's the problem. And I grew up in Chicago, a block from where Obama lives. I know the neighborhood. I watched the University of Chicago do blockbusting there. That's what made me interested in the ideas of Henry George and the importance of land in the economy. And that's the people who brought me here, were Prosper Australia, to talk precisely about how real estate really is what the economy is all about.
So you are an advocate of the Henry George principles?
Certainly of the land tax, yes. I believe that if you tax land, that would have brought down the property prices.
Henry George had a bit of a flourish here some time ago. You know, he had a lot of followers, and particularly in Tasmania, as I recall.
Yes, I think that I've met the Georges here, and they're the most reasonable people I've met of any Georges in the world. I do not have anything to do with the Georges elsewhere, but the people here seem well-balanced and reasonable because the movement here was founded by other people than Henry George.
Okay, look, we haven't got a lot of time, but okay. I'm now fascinated by this revelation. What would Henry George do with, would he be forgiving debt? Would he not be encouraging private land ownership?
He would encourage private land ownership. He said nothing about debt, but he said, look, you don't get rich by having high housing prices that you have to go into debt for. You get rich by levying the taxes on the land and keeping the housing prices down, because whatever the tax collector relinquishes, you're going to end up paying to the bank as interest. And once you pay it to the bank of interest, the government now has to raise the tax somewhere else, and the government's going to raise the tax by taxing labor and capital and increasing the price of doing business and the price of living, and you're going to price yourself out of the market. So if you want to be competitive, you want the tax not to fall on labor and capital, but to fall on the land, and that would have kept housing prices low, and believe it or not, Australia would be richer and happier and prosperous if it had.
Before I let you go, I've got to get your views, and perhaps Henry's, on emissions trading, the new economy of climate change mitigation. Good thing, bad thing, nonsense.
The way it's being handled is to make a killing for the financial underwriters, basically. There's a huge amount of trading in it. I don't think it's going to change the pattern of emissions or the pattern of global pollution. I think it'll make financial fortunes for trading in the rate at which we're polluting the earth.
What are you investing in lately, Michael?
Short-term treasury bills.
Exactly.
I'm not a risk taker.
You heard it first on Late Night Live. Michael, thanks for popping in. Michael Hudson, a former Wall Street financial analyst, now president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of, how is Missouri really pronounced?
Missouri is how I pronounce it, because I'm from Minnesota.
Michael's here for a series of public lectures over the next couple of weeks. He'll be speaking in Melbourne, Canberra, Sydney and Adelaide. Go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/late-night-live, and please don't slash us, and you'll find a link with further details, LNL, on ABC Radio National.